I'm Christopher Light, and this is Open Source, a radio conversation that invites you in at the website, radioopensource.org. We're picking up the Monday night race and class thread that led through the crack cocaine era to mass incarceration. More young black men in prison than in college in America today. This hour, the reentry moment. Where are you going to go? Who's waiting for you? What's the life you're going forward or back to when the bit behind the walls is over? These are first questions on the minds of roughly 650,000 men and some women leaving prison this year. Here's an impression from the radio documentarian Dan Collison.
When you get out to the street, y'all go down a set of stairs. When you get down that set of stairs, go across the street, get on that sidewalk, go to your left. Straight down that street, about a block and a half on the right, big Greyhound bus. They'll cash your checks down there for nothing.
We're out of here.
Steak dinner.
Steak and salad.
I haven't seen a girl in so long.
Hello, world.
And just to have that warm feeling with a lady.
Relax.
It's like being born again.
Relax. I'm free. Thank God. Thank you, Jesus. Beautiful thing.
Don't look back, dude.
I'm trying not to.
Don't look back. Whatever you do,
don't look back.
That's from Dan Collison's piece called Huntsville Blues, as in Huntsville, Texas. Put your experience, put your imagination into a comment on our site at www.radioopensource.org. We're reading you as we go. Debbie Muckamal is the prisoner reentry specialist at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. She's also the co-author of a 50-state compendium on barriers to reentry called After Prison. I have to ask you, Debbie, if you were coming out of prison, where would you want to reenter the world, and how many ways are there to do it?
Well, I know it sounds a little biased because I live here in New York, but I'd probably want to come home to New York, given the range of programs that we have in New York City, the kinds of legal restrictions that we have in New York, and just...
What do you mean legal restrictions?
There's a range of barriers that people face because they either have an arrest record or a conviction record that can affect their ability to obtain a job, obtain housing, obtain public benefits and food stamps, even be able to have the right to vote.
Where would you want not to be returning?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, there are places that have more legal restrictions than New York, but they may have some good programming. I just generally wouldn't want to be returning home from prison. I think it's a very difficult road for someone, and it's a moment of a lot of anticipation and hope, and we don't often meet that hope with the warmest of support.
Roll the tape back a few weeks or months before freedom. How do prisons and prisoners get ready for the day?
Well, it's an interesting question because I think several years ago, there was absolutely no preparation for release. We simply gave someone a bus ticket. We might have given them $25, and we probably even dropped them off in the middle of the night and said, we hope you don't come back. I think that a lot of departments of corrections have begun to see the need to prepare people for release as part of their responsibility. And so more and more departments of corrections around the country are engaging in what we call discharge planning or reentry prior to someone being released from prison. So now maybe 30 days, 60 days before someone comes home, they may begin the process of preparing. They may begin to do a resume. They may begin to do some job coaching so that they know how to apply for a job. They may begin to get a list of resources from someone in the community that lets them know, you know, which community-based organizations they can go to access medical treatment, to access drug treatment, to access, you know, job placement services, that kind of thing.
You say they may. It sounds very, very informal and chancy.
It's informal because it's not yet institutionalized among every department of correction. And while there are some wonderful model programs around the country that are developing, they're still, to the large extent, demonstration projects. And I would not say that they are available to every person leaving prison. We're talking about 650,000 people who are leaving state and federal prison. And we can't also forget that there's 8 to 10 million people who cycle in and out of local jail.
We're having this conversation because Professor Bruce Western, whom you probably know, suggested a couple of weeks ago that, you know, wouldn't it be good for a man to have 5 points of identification, simple IDs to get started with on hitting the street. What in fact happens? And I'd love you to kind of survey the, you know, a man and the obstacles ahead of him on right. on reentry day.
Right. Well, let me paint who that person is. That person's probably a male, as you said, because 93% of the prison population is male, though we should not forget that women are the fastest growing segment of the prison population. But that individual is probably male. That individual is probably in prison for a drug-related offense. The person's probably did about 3 years in prison. And the person probably served time in a prison that is very far away from the place that they are returning.
How far?
It could be 500 miles. Matt, we have 70 prisons here in New York City. Most of them are in New York State, and most of them are in upstate New York, in rural communities, which makes it difficult for that individual to have maintained contact with their family. It's probably very expensive for that individual, for that family to have visited the prisoner. And then telephone charges are extremely expensive because the individual has to call their family on a collect call system.
So fill this out. What rate of active drug problems, what rate of medical issues, and then what's the financial situation for these men?
Right. So that individual is coming home, as we said, to a community far away from where they were. They most likely 80% of individuals who go to prison are there for have some kind of substance abuse problem, which they probably didn't get treated for in prison. So they're coming home. Hopefully, they're going to want to seek drug treatment, but that's going to be difficult to get. There's not a sufficient drug treatment in the community. They may need Medicaid in order to pay for that drug treatment. And just the process of getting Medicaid or public assistance may be difficult because there's a waiting period. If that individual was lucky enough to get to the public assistance office the day they returned home, there's usually a 45 to 90 day waiting period before those benefits kick in. Why that individual couldn't have applied for benefits before they were released, that's a different question. But they're coming home, and their first immediate needs are probably looking for a place to live and looking for food to eat. They've probably been given something like $25, and individuals who have been away for a while may want to use that to buy a nice dinner for themselves. Doesn't leave a lot of money for a place to live or for the days ahead.
What's your experience with, effective help? I mean, are there girlfriends, families, churches, public places, hostels, whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yep. There can be great social networks for people to tap into. They could want to go home and return to a family member, to live with a family member, but that even so can be tricky because of federal housing laws make it difficult for an individual who wants to return to live with a family who is in either Section 8 or public housing. We've basically said, the way the laws are now written, that if someone wants to come home to live with their family member and they live in public housing, that family is then putting their tenancy at risk of being evicted, because we've also said that we don't want public housing premises to be full of people who have been convicted of crimes. So that individual may have.
But now they've done their time. Until they smoke the wrong cigarette or shoot up, is there any burden on a family receiving a member back, who's not even on parole?
There's no burden. I mean, we would hope that the family member would like to welcome the individual home. But let's also keep in mind that if this individual may have burned bridges before they went to prison, and then in the period that the person was away, while the family may love that individual a lot, things might have gotten a lot easier for that family while that individual is in prison. And having the individual return home shakes up the entire dynamics of that family structure. And it's not easy. And we don't always do all that's necessary to bolster this and support the family members so that they are adequately prepared for individuals returning home. Just last week, I heard an individual at John Jay College speak. He's a student whose mother went to prison when he was six, and his mother just got released from prison about a month ago. He wasn't even informed that his mom was coming home. So he didn't even have any kind of preparation, emotional preparation, physical preparation for what it would be like to all of a sudden have his mother living with him.
Let me ask, if you're an armed robber, when you come out of prison, the guys you did armed robbery with are ready to receive you back into the industry, so to speak. If you're a junkie or even a dealer, who receives you back in the industry, in the fraternity?
Well, you could be going back to old social networks and to be with people who, you know, who you knew when you were committing crimes. But many individuals don't go back to, they want to actually start their lives over again, and they want to do the right thing. And in some cases, actually, because of their conditions of parole or probation, they may be prohibited from fraternizing with other people who are on probation or parole. So they may be actually legally barred from being around other people who have criminal records.
And are those bars enforced?
They're often enforced. It sort of depends. Parole officers, unfortunately, have extremely high caseloads, and so they're not able to really offer the kind of supervision that I think the public sort of
hold it there, Debbie. We're going to come back after a short break. We're talking about the day after prison, starting off with Debbie Muckamal at John Jay College in New York City. Join the conversation at www.radioopensource.org.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the Open Source blogger-in-chief. Open Source is on vacation right now, so as America observes the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, we are rebroadcasting 5 episodes of our series on race and class. We recorded them in the months that followed Katrina last year. We are certain that some huge, unprecedented news event is breaking right now, and the rest of the news media is all over it, but we are enjoying the last days of summer. We hope you are too, and we'll be back live after Labor Day. Leave us your postcards at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking tonight about the day after prison, re-entering society when you've been out. Blogger Mark Olmsted was in jail for almost a year for selling crystal meth. He did a lot of soul searching to make sense of how someone like him, an upper middle class college educated guy, ended up behind bars, especially once it became clear that Mark had advantages that most of his cellmates did not.
I remember thinking, why isn't prison enough of a deterrent? So many of these guys keep coming back because no one likes being there. And slowly, when I got to ask about their histories and find out what they were about, I realized that they didn't like or tolerate prison any more than anybody else, except that in order to stay out of prison, it competed favorably with the life that they would have to lead in order to stay on the straight and narrow. And that is one of being economically marginalized and, above all, having very little status in the eyes of society. And that's what young men want. They want status among their peers. And they get more status in a life of crime or in prison than they do trying to make it in a world where having a substandard education gets you very little. You know, there is very little support to become reintegrated to the community, and these people are forced to parole back to the very same places or regions that they got in trouble in the first place. So you're going back to the same old hood with the same old people you ran with and got in trouble with the first time, and the first thing they're going to do is say, let's get drunk or high. It's the first thing that they all said that they wanted to do since they got out. And so, of course, that's an immediate parole violation. So, you know, 90% of the guys I was in prison with were on parole violations because you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, hanging out with the wrong people, or you just pissed dirty, you know, because you couldn't stay sober. Parole is a broken system that is meant for people to fail. You know, so you end up having a life where your main life ends up being in prison, and then your vacations are when you're on the outside.
Mark Olmsted was released in November of 2004 from a minimum security facility in Chino, California. He now lives in Los Angeles. You can read about his experience on his blog, Mark Olmsted's blog, at markolmsted.com/blog. Keith Hooper is the chief of operations at the Talbot Hall halfway back program in Kearney, New Jersey. Once upon a time, he served 3 years in New Jersey State Prison. Keith Hooper, welcome. You left prison about a decade ago. Can you reconstruct that day for us?
Which day you want me to reconstruct?
Coming back, the day after prison.
Well, the day after prison, basically because of the program I came through. I came through a program of community education centers in 94. I did approximately 15 months in that halfway house. So I was pretty much situated because I had learned about the disease of addiction. I learned about how to save money. I learned about, you know, the different things I needed to do in order for me to continue to stay in society. So my reentry was pretty much together for me because I took the information that I received and understood that this is what I needed to do.
How did you learn it?
I learned it the hard way.
I was going to say.
The way I learned it was, you know, when you're coming from prison, you need to understand, when you're coming from prison, you have a different mindset. Your mindset is basically this, that either you don't want to come back, but you're going to need information to understand how not to come back. Mm-hmm. You know, the slogan, just say no, to me, I just never understood. What you mean, just say no? I'm in the streets every day and using drugs, and I say no all the damn time, but every time I turn around, I'm high. So the information I received, because I had, like, a senior counselor that really, you know, like nurtured me even when I was being difficult. Because coming from prison, you're very difficult. You know what I'm saying? You like a piece of coal, and, you know, you don't believe in nobody. You don't trust nobody. So this person just, you know, laid my whole record out to me and showed me exactly what I was doing and said, listen, this is what your best thinking got you. Now, if you don't want to come back to jail, I have a plan for you. If you follow this plan and follow it, you won't come back to jail. And I just followed that plan. I didn't want to come back to jail no more. I was done.
But you probably heard Mark Olmsted just a moment ago saying that for a lot of those guys, they expect to be back in jail. Mark Olmsted said, your main life is in prison, your vacations are on the outside, but you know, in effect, you're headed back. For how many men is that true, and how do you break that expectation?
It's receiving information again. This is what I'm telling you. You have to get the information. Because the go back is, you don't just, you know, deal with these guys and break the law with these guys. A lot of these guys that you're dealing with and go to jail with are guys you actually grew up with all your life.
Yes.
You know, so these are guys that you have strong ties to. So when you come to prison, you know, and you see that all of them comes to jail, you believe that you can do nothing but come to jail. You don't want to come to jail, but you don't believe you can do anything differently. And that's why with the information, the proper information being given to you, you can. You can. And that's why, you know, I thank God every day, you know, for whatever I went through, my incarceration, and for just the blessing of coming through that program and receiving that information the way I received the information, because I was horrible in the streets, man. I mean, nothing was safe around me. I mean, you know, I tried everything. And to just to get this information and change is truly a blessing. And then based on me changing and different people knowing how I used to be in them streets, that opened the eyes for a lot of people. See, we need to see physical proof that this process works. Keith, I don't want to hear about that book. I don't want to hear nothing. I need to see physical. Show me somebody there to work with. And that's what we do. You know, I mean, because we lived our life based on that. You know, you ain't going to tell me that something get me high. I need, who using it? Oh, he had that? And that's the type of evidence we be needing, because we don't believe in nothing unless we see it. You know, we have a lot, our belief systems are just so twisted and it's just so crazy that, you know, it takes people that understand what we're dealing with in order to help us help ourselves to keep ourselves out of these situations.
Keith Hooper, you're helping us. Debbie Muckamal, how unusual is Keith Hooper's choice? And then I want to hear more from you, Keith, about how difficult is that choice? But Debbie, how many people come back? How many people take Keith's course?
Yeah, recidivism rates are a little bit tricky to measure, but about 2/3 of people do get rearrested within 3 years of coming home from prison, and then about 40% of people end up getting reconvicted for a crime and reincarcerated. Hmm. But what is tricky is knowing whether or not they're being reincarcerated for a new crime, that is, they've committed a new offense, or they're being reincarcerated for a parole violation, as Mark mentioned, for having a dirty urine, for violating a condition of parole, like their curfew. There are a number of states where a large majority of the prisoners are people who are violating their terms of parole as opposed to committing new crimes.
So this gets higher mathematics very quickly, but Keith Hooper, how difficult is the choice you made?
The only difficult of my choice was leaving my friends and associates that I've known so long. Hmm. Having to now deal with a whole new association of people. And, you know, in New Jersey, you know, we have politicians. I mean, like Judge D'Amico, he oversees parole here. He makes, you know, he's treatment-oriented. He understands that just incarcerating a person based on them being misinformed of their addiction is not the answer. You have to send them to these programs that, you know, that's available here. And, you know, what's worked for me, Community Education Center's program, it helped me. I mean, and I'm still involved in it because I'm the chairperson of the executive board for the Alumni Association. So I'm out there dealing with people that complete these programs and helping them go back into society.
You mentor men now through your Halfway Back program. Give us some counsel here. What do you tell guys?
I tell guys that my worst day with me not using and breaking the law is 20 times better than my best day when I was out there selling drugs, doing what I was doing in them streets. And they'll say to me, because, you know, it ain't much I have to say to them, because a lot of them know me. They know me. They've heard of me. You know, they seen what I used to do. They know how I used to be. So the proof is right there. So then when I just start talking to them about the information and how it's necessary for them to understand this, it just instantly clicks in for them. And it grabs to me that, you know, and this process is, you know, with this, you know, reentry thing and everything like that, we work directly with city council members of different municipalities that works with us. We do a lot of community organizations. We go into juvenile detention centers to stop these guys and females from continuing their life of crime. We go into schools. I mean, and we go into these facilities every month and talk to these guys. And we have a list of resources. We make action plans. You know, we gather employees. We tell them about the federal bonding program that's available, the tax credits you get for hiring an ex-offender. You know, all these things are available, and we let these employers know. Good jobs. Not just, you know, when guys want to go to school, we encourage them to take a job. Take this little job and just go to school. Get, you know what I'm saying, get the grant money that they have available for ex-offenders. These are the things that we're pushing to these.
Stand by. Martin Horn is on the line. He is the New York City Commissioner of Correction, the biggest jail system of its kind in America. He was also the Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections in the late 1990s. Martin Horn. In brief, what is the city's interest, and what is its responsibility? What does it do with these men after they leave?
Well, our interest is clear. We're a Department of Correction. New York is the safest big city in America, and we'd like to do even better. And the way to do it is by breaking the cycle of crime and ensuring that when people leave our jails, they leave in a fashion that increases the chances that they're going to succeed. And everything that Keith was saying is certainly on the money. You need to have a plan. If you don't have a plan, if you fail to plan, you're planning to fail. And you need mentorship, and you need a halfway house, and you need a job, and you need to stay sober. And we try and help people accomplish those things.
Tell us exactly how it works, and what is your even legal or political responsibility as they go? I mean, you could certainly say, you know, we'll see you when you're back. What are you bound to do with and for these men?
Well, you know, that's a great question. In fact, because we run a jail system and we have just a small number of people who are sentenced for us for sentences that last no more than a year, actually, when they leave us, we're under no obligation to them. We have no legal hold over them. So what we're doing is a very, very interesting experiment because we believe that if we offer to individuals who are leaving jail something of value that will help them to succeed upon release, that they will take advantage of it. And so what we have is a very aggressive discharge planning process, and it's our goal that every sentenced inmate who leaves our jails in New York City leaves with the kinds of identification that they need to be able to work. In this day and age, the kinds of 5 points of identification that you mentioned, mm-hmm. We are spending over $5 million to provide jobs for up to 5,000 people a year who leave our jails so that we can provide them each day when they leave the jail, transportation away from the jail to a place where they can obtain employment on the very day that they leave, and literally be paid every day. They don't have to wait 2 weeks for their first paycheck.
What kinds of jobs?
Well, the transitional jobs are low-skilled construction, demolition, painting, a variety of jobs that you can plug people into rather quickly, and then we provide them with vocational development so that we can place them in private sector, unsubsidized jobs, much more highly skilled jobs. We're also providing discharge plans to approximately 6,000 additional inmates each year, and those plans address sobriety, education.
Did we lose you?
Hello?
Sorry. Who's there? Who's not there?
Thanks, Ward.
Keith Hooper, you're there.
I'm there.
Was he making sense?
He was making a lot of sense, and that's just exactly what you have to do. You have to have high-ranking officials that's willing to go that far, and that's exactly what I'm saying. When you have a judge and that's willing to, you know, oversee the parole and you know, get on and tell different people that he know, it works better. The system works better. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, I give a lot of credit to Judge D'Amico for doing that. You know,
well, Martin Horn, though, is talking about jobs, transitional jobs, and off. You know, they're not. They're not jobs you'd dream of getting at the
But end Chris, of the... what you have to understand is, and what I encourage them to do is, we have to get them first acclimated to working.
Okay.
So at the beginning, you have to, because a lot of times when we have to do a resume, we end up having to do a resume with everything listed at Department of Corrections. Because a lot of jobs they have within the Department of Corrections can be counted as a job. and a lot of them don't have no work history. So you have to get them started somewhere, but long as you point them in the direction of some type of a goal. You know, I mean, that's a good start because.
But talk to that guy who has no work history, as you say. He may have been a dealer. He was probably a user, and you're trying to interest him in a demolition job.
What you have to understand is they just coming from prison,
right?
Where they was making $1.50 a day. So now I'm telling you that you may make $7 an hour. Now you do the math. That's what I tell them. You do the math. If you could work for the state of New Jersey for $1.50 a day, you should be willing to work for yourself for $7 an hour, and you're going to be able to go in the direction that I'm pointing you in to where you can make more because based on your experience, you can't do nothing else.
I think also...
Debbie Muckamal, please.
I think also it's needing to tell people that it's easier to obtain a job once you're in the labor market. So it may be a first job that is not an ideal job, but that it's easier to move up in the labor market once you're there. The other thing is that people need to learn patience and that immediate gratification that may have been the style of their life before they went to prison is not really going to be how they're necessarily going to lead their life when they get out if they want to remain crime-free and productive in society.
Debbie, Martin Horn is back. Martin, I wanted to ask you, what is the real work of these heavy caseload parole officers who have huge powers of intrusion if they ever had the time? How do they fit into your program?
Well, parole officers really don't much fit into our program because we're a local jail system and most of the individuals who leave our jails are not on parole. There are individuals who are locked up in our jails for parole violations and many of them do return to parole and many of the individuals who are in our jail are in jail because their parole officer has arrested them for a violation of one of the housekeeping, what I call housekeeping rules of parole. And I think Keith mentioned that you can be locked up by your parole officer for a hot urine, which means you've used drugs, but you can also be locked up because you didn't come to see your parole officer, or as Debbie said, because you violated curfew. Once you have parole, you have to have a relationship between the parole officer and the parolee, and so there are a lot of rules to enforce that relationship, and those rules generate violations that have nothing to do with criminality necessarily.
Hmm. We're talking about the day after prison, and there are many ways to do it. The odds are against you, it sounds like, almost any place, but the circumstances vary all over the country. New York may be the best, Debbie Muckamal says, and there are all sorts of programs that work, like New Jersey's Halfway Back program. Make your own judgment, make your own comment at our website, www.radioopensource. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the day after prison. Debbie Muckamal, put what we're hearing in a kind of national context. New Jersey has a halfway back program. New York City follows its prisoners beyond its almost legal obligation. What works here? How unusual is this?
Well, I think what's unusual specifically about what's happening in New York is the extent to which it's happening. And that fact that you have a commissioner who's taken leadership over a course of several years to really try to improve discharge planning and is doing it along with other commissioners like the commissioner of the Department of Homeless Services and involving the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. So I think what we're seeing in New York isn't necessarily what we're seeing in other places. But I do want to say that there are states and localities all over the country that are thinking really creatively about addressing reentry. So, for instance, in Baltimore and in Philadelphia and in Chicago, you now have an office of reentry out of the mayor's office. In places like Boston and San Francisco, you've got city councils who have recently passed ordinances to try to improve reentry outcomes by dealing with employment issues. So you're seeing jurisdictions all over the country, both on a state and local level, really try to address this. And at the federal level, you've got bipartisan legislation that has been introduced in both the House and the Senate to comprehensively address reentry through what's called the Second Chance Bill. So I think you're seeing a lot of places just say, we can't afford this anymore from a financial point of view, from a human capital point of view. We can't afford to continue to lock people up and have a recidivism rate that means that nearly half of the people who come home are going to go right back in.
It's a kind of phenomenal consciousness that we all live with, that we put dangerous and difficult people away, but we know they're coming back. And yet we do rather an astonishingly little preparation. Could I ask you, Martin Horn, you step right up to that word corrections, implying sending them up better than they were when they came in, maybe even rehabilitation. But that became a non-word since, I don't know, the 70s, perhaps, the idea of actually changing men behind bars. What's your ambition?
My ambition is to make a contribution to public safety. I think that's the job of the jails. I think every dollar that the public invests in prisons and jails ought to have some sort of public safety payback. And I think that's what people expect of us. If we can't make people safer by what we do, then perhaps those dollars should be spent in a better way. I don't necessarily subscribe to the notion of rehabilitation after a lot of years. I don't quite know what it means. I don't quite know how we ever determine that it's occurred. And it suggests sort of a medical model, and I'm not convinced that there's anything medically wrong with the men and women who go to prison. I think if you listen to Keith, you understand that. It's about making choices. It's about having resources. What we do know is that when people leave prison or jail, every one of them has some statistical probability of failing or succeeding. And so we believe in New York City that our job is to increase the odds that they succeed and decrease the odds that they fail. And we know that in order to succeed, they have to stay sober. I think that's abundantly clear. The overwhelming majority, more than 70% of the men and women in prison and jail, are addicted to drugs or alcohol or both. And we also know that an alarmingly high number of them have mental health problems simultaneously. Sometimes their drug and alcohol use is to mask their mental illness. We know that to succeed in today's world, you have to work. You have to be able to support yourself. Mm-hmm. And we know, especially in the big cities, that you need a place to live. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we face. And we know that if people can't overcome those three challenges, sobriety, work, mm-hmm. and housing, that they'll fail. And so we're working with the Department of Homeless Services because we know that a lot of the people that we see in our jails are the same people that they see in the homeless shelters. And the mayor has said that we're going to reduce the incidence of homelessness in New York City by 2/3, and I think we've only got 3 years left. So we're working very hard to reduce the cycle of homelessness and jail. We're working very hard to ensure that people in our jails are sober while they're in jail, that they learn how to stay sober, that they understand the disease of addiction, and that we connect them when they leave to somebody who can help them stay sober. And as I was saying before, I was so rudely cut off by the answering machine, that they have a reasonable chance of finding a job. And I think if we take care of sobriety and work and housing, the rehabilitation will take care of itself.
Martin Horn in New York City, stand by. Brendan Greeley, our blogger-in-chief, is making his own reentry after a grueling week of vacation. Brendan, the blogosphere missed you.
And I miss the blogosphere.
Avek Fritz wrote on the blog this afternoon, and I'm quoting him directly, "We often hear that government should perform more like businesses. So to borrow a management technique, I ask, whose job performance is based on how well people do after they are released from prison?" So it's a question for Martin Horn. Is recidivism a way not just to judge the former inmate, but the system? And to whom other than the former inmate can we apply some sort of incentive to keep rates down?
Yeah, that's a very interesting and complex question. You know, we have a saying among corrections administrators that there's not a warden in the country that lost his job for failing to rehabilitate someone. But, you know, God forbid there's one escape. And I think the sad truth is that correctional administrators, by and large, are not judged by how well they affect recidivism. On the other hand, there are so many variables that go into it. As Debbie said, two-thirds of the people who are released are arrested within 3 years, but arrests are not necessarily indicative of the criminal behavior of the people released. They may be indicative of increased police activity. We know that the ability to find jobs is a function of the economy. We know that the ability to obtain treatment for drug and alcohol addiction is often dependent upon federal funding. So there are a whole host of variables. Most importantly, I think it is the ex-offender. I deeply believe that it is each offender's responsibility to lead a life that is law-abiding upon their release. I think our responsibility is to give them the tools that they can do that with. I think that our measurement is imperfect. I think we can do better at it. But it's a very, very difficult question to answer and very difficult to hold any one person or one governmental entity responsible for. If there's a housing crisis in the city and people are coming out of prison and can't afford housing, then I'm not sure that we can blame the prison system for that.
Listen to this. Karen Witz is a police detective in Lowell, Massachusetts. And she's in charge of the city's prisoner reentry program. Karen Witz, welcome. It's an unusual job for a police officer, is it not?
Yes, it is.
What exactly do you do?
Well, I am a detective at the Lowell Police Department. I am assigned to prisoner reentry. So what that means is that when the prisoners are released from either a House of Correction or Department of Corrections, I go to their home and visit them.
And you say, welcome back. Then what?
Welcome back. Well, it's something like that. I introduce myself, introduce the Lowell Police Department, and at that point, we have a brochure that we had made up with a lot of numbers on there for some resources, and I agree. You know, it is incumbent upon them to take their own initiative and to, you know, get out there and try to, you know, stay straight. However, sometimes they need a little bit of assistance, and if they've been away for a while, they're not quite sure on who to contact. So we have a brochure already made up with some numbers. We give them that. But I also let them know that I do monitor all the police reports on a daily basis. And before I even go, I do my homework, though. And I know that if they're on probation or if they're on parole, I know who their PO is. I know what their conditions are. So when I'm speaking with them, I reiterate their conditions. I let them know that if their name comes across our desk, if we, you know, see their police report coming across, even as a suspect, I will pass that information on.
But this is interesting. You're both good cop and bad cop, and you're also a woman. This carrot and stick here, all sorts of warning, but maybe a little reassurance too. How do you put it in the package?
You know, honestly, it's pretty easy. We've been doing this now, just prisoner reentry for a whole year, pretty close to a year. And I have to tell you, it's so well received. We go to the home, and I have never once been turned away. I introduce myself and you know, explain to them that I am there to see that they don't go back to jail. Most of them. Almost all of them, actually, are welcoming any assistance they can get. I've never been told, you know, don't come back or they're not interested.
But what do they need on your own observation in terms of cash, drug treatment, church?
Well, hopefully when they first getting out that they don't need too much of any of that except for cash, to be honest. You know, they've been incarcerated for quite some time, some of them, so they should be drug free. Again, it's just letting them know that the police are here. We know they're out, and we're monitoring them. I mean, they get that message without having to, you know, come right out and say it. Although sometimes I do say that, you know, I'm looking at police reports every day, and if I do see that your name's coming across, I'm passing it along, you know. But I also encourage them that if they start to fall off and they think that they're heading down a wrong road, to give me a call. For example, if it's with substance abuse, I can refer them to a substance abuse agency. Or maybe they're just having a hard time trying to find some way to do the community service. And we'll work with some people to get them in so that they can do their community service, so they're not violating either their probation or their parole.
Martin Horn, could New York City ever do something like this?
Well, New York City is an awfully big city.
Lowell is a nice little city, but it's got a serious drug problem. And I don't know. Are they comparable?
I really don't think they're comparable. The scale on New York makes it awfully daunting, and what you need is some consistency. And also, I really wonder what it is we're trying to achieve. If the issue is simply accountability, we certainly could achieve that. And in fact, we let the police know everyone who's coming out, and they certainly know everyone who's on parole or probation who gets arrested is known to them, and the probation agency in New York City works closely with them, and we can certainly hold offenders accountable. I think the challenge for us, and we're discharging probably 10,000 people or more to the streets from sentences of 30 days or more, and the challenge is, how do you help them find a job? The challenge is, if they don't have a family, how do you help them find work? And I think it takes more than a single police officer to achieve that. I think it requires that we do more of what we're doing, which is to engage community-based organizations that specialize in doing these things. It requires that we work collaboratively with our sister agencies and government to break down some of the barriers so that offenders can reunite with families in public housing in ways that don't compromise the safety of public housing.
Karen Witts, I'm just wondering, how different is your job from that of a parole officer?
Well, to be honest, parole has a little bit of teeth. In other words, you know, if they do violate, parole has they can sentence them back to jail, you know, violate them, and they can go back. Sometimes I don't have, other than making an arrest, I don't have that, other than passing on their name. However, it's working for us. It's where we're looking at the people. We're monitoring where they are. If we start to see, for example, in one neighborhood, maybe some crime that's rising due to some specific, for example, B&Es, you know, we're going out and we're talking again to people, making sure they're right on the right track, you know, it's pretty easy to see if they're falling off.
Keith Hooper, are you still there?
Yep.
How would a detective Karen Witts have looked to you, you know, on your day back from prison?
How or what?
Well, I'm just wondering, could a detective officer like Karen Witts have given you a break or a help?
I commend them for doing what they're doing. But if I already have a parole officer, I mean, I'm not going to be comfortable with someone from the police department overseeing me, coming to my house, doing things like that. To me, you know, I'm doing my time, I'm completing my time, and I'm reporting to my parole officer and doing everything I'm supposed to do. But I will feel more comfortable with talking to people that, you know, that's been through some of the things I've been through, that understands the trials and tribulations of being in this neighborhood and the different people I need to stay away from. So I'm more inclined to get with people that come from where I come from to help me, who's been doing what I'm trying to do.
But here's Officer Witts at the door telling you two messages. One, we know you're back and we're keeping an eye on you, but
I'm not comfortable with that.
And then the other part is, if you feel yourself on the slippery slope, give me a call.
When we come home, we already have doubts of us actually succeeding, and we got someone. Like I said, I got a parole officer already now.
Karen Witts, can you imagine a man like Keith Hooper on your case list?
I don't know this gentleman. I have to tell you, though, I have many inmates coming out of Department of Corrections, and one gentleman I spoke to the other day who did 20 years and thanked me, I can't tell you, at least 5 times in our conversation for actually coming out and trying to assist him. And that has been the consensus with all of the inmates that I have been dealing with. And if you, I guess my feeling is, and I'm not speaking just for this gentleman that was just talking, but if you're nervous, if I'm out looking at you, you know, maybe things aren't going too well. You do have a parole officer, and, you know, sometimes we do our home visits with the parole officer or with the probation officer. So again, most of the time, all of these people that we're dealing with are doing very well and have absolutely no problem with us coming to the home. You know, I come to the home, I leave, it's a couple of minutes, and, you know, I don't go back on a weekly basis, that's for sure.
This is fascinating. Debbie Mukamal, bring it home here. What are we learning? Comparatively, state and city, jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but what remain the giant obstacles?
It's the number of people coming home and the kinds of needs that the commissioner spoke about. Everyone coming home needs a job. They need a place to live, and those things are hard to come by. 80% of employers do background checks, and they don't want to hire people with criminal records. It's difficult, despite the kinds of incentives that we can tell them about. You know, we have a crisis of affordable housing in our country for everyone, not just for people who are coming home from prison, but those who are coming home from prison have an additional obstacle to face. So it's I think partly just the sheer number of people and trying to manage that process. And for so many people, that is what's plaguing our cities.
And you didn't even mention substance and drug epidemics, but I don't know. At the end of an hour, are we making progress or not?
Absolutely.
Stick with it. It's a noble calling, and we'd love to come back to this subject again. Debbie Mukamal, thank you. Marty Horn, thank you. Keith Hooper, keep doing it, and thank you. Karen Witz, keep making the calls. You can continue talking about the day after prison. You can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, promoting health by protecting human rights, www.phrusa.org. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, and Robin Amer, with help from Greta Pemberton and Henry Shepard. Robin Moore was our engineer, thanks to Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister of Long Haul Productions. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.